So the origin is actually a friend of mine at work asked me this question essentially. He said he was in the market for a car and he found one that he liked. And he and the seller agreed on the price and that they would buy it. And the seller said, okay, bring the money. If you bring the money tomorrow, the car is yours. And my friend had the money. But that day he went back online and he actually found that a similar car in better condition was being sold also nearby in Israel. And he wondered, can he, for a cheaper price actually, and he wondered, can he contact that person and see if he can get that cheaper price and switch over. I think there's some other people who are joining, expecting this to be the tribute to Rabbi Sachs and Rabbi Tanzer, which was 2 hours ago. Okay, no, you can enjoy this year. So my friend asked me, he said, can I wiggle out of the other deal? He said, I really actually just want to do a test drive with this other car and see if it's really available. But in the meantime, I can't pay for the car that I agreed to pay for. So what should I do? So I wasn't sure, but I told him I thought that it was a little bit unethical. But I did something interesting. I said, well, let's find out from everybody else what they think. So we were in the office. So we went around to the rest of the team saying, as Israelis, what do you think should be done in this situation? What do you think everybody said?
I'm guessing they said go for the cheaper model.
Across the board, every single person said, you have every right to go and find out about the other car and purchase the other car. You made no commitment, and the other person doesn't expect there to be a commitment. And almost every single person had a story where they were messed over because either on the buyer side or on the seller side that they thought that they had a deal. Every single person said, until you have the money in your hands, there's no deal. Or until you have the car in your hand, there's no deal. Every single person said that. I wasn't so happy, but that seemed to be what everybody was saying. Now my friend said to me, he said, I have a kutz. He said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tell this person that I just don't have the money yet. Saying I need another day to get the money. And that way I can buy myself some time. And he said, and I want to see what he says to me. He says, the fact is he actually did this. He said to the person, I don't have the money yet. I need another day. And the person said back to him, he said, okay, listen, I'll hold the car for you for another day, but you have to give me 1,000 shekel as a down payment, and then I'll hold the car for you. Otherwise, I'm not going to hold it for you. And what my friend said to me was, he said, that tells me that he doesn't think that we're set, right? He doesn't think, and in fact, it tells me that, he's ready to go sell it to somebody else if I don't give him 1,000 shekel. So from that perspective, he thinks that if that guy's not treating it as if it's already a done deal, then I don't have to treat it as if it's a done deal. That's how he thought. So that's kind of where we are. Now, I want to remind you of everything we learned last time. We were talking about Mechusrei Amana, about being unethical, about how, according to halakha, a verbal agreement is not a binding agreement legally in halakha, which means you can't be sued for it. However, breaking a verbal agreement is Mechusrei Amana. The rabbis looked badly on it. It was called Misha Parah. It's basically Hashem who took care of the Dor HaMabul. He's going to also take care of you. It's considered deeply, deeply unethical. And so it's asur. Essentially, it's asur to do it, but there's no legal claim against you if you do break confidence. That being the case, there are mitigating circumstances we talked about last week in the case of the selling of the house, where, for example, there was a radical difference between the perceived price and the actual price. Or if there's a radical difference in time, the market price for that object drastically changes and there's a legitimate reason. Or if the other person is being unethical in some way towards you, then there's no problem with you being unethical back. Okay, fine. Question is as follows. This I found in Rav Elazar Malamed, his Pnei Halacha. He deals with this question. He says, Adam sikem im koneh shera'a et mechonito shimkor lo ota be'erev b'mechir mesuyam. This is our case. Two people agreed. The buyer said that he would purchase the car at a certain price. Another buyer came and was willing to pay the seller more. האם חובה למוכר למכור את מכונית הראשון במחיר המסוכם, או שמותר לו למכור את המכונית במחיר גבוה יותר לקונה השני? Can he sell it to the better paying buyer? So Rav Melamed writes, he says, על פי הלכה, צריך המוכר למכור את מכוניתו לקונה הראשון במחיר שסוכם. The seller has to sell it to the original buyer. Why? זאת משום שהסיכום שלהם, למרות שנעשה בדיבור בלבד, מחייב אותו מבחינה מוסרית. He has an ethical obligation to sell it to the original buyer. ואומנם, אם ירצה להפר את דברו ולמכור את המכונית במחיר יקר יותר, if he wants to sell it for a higher price, לראשון או לשני, לא ניתן יהיה לתבוע אותו בבית דין ולקוף אותו לעמוד בדיברו, משום שעדיין לא נעשה קניין מחייב, וכן לא נחתם שטר. The fact is, as we said, there's no legally binding obligation. If he goes and he sells it to the second person, the first person cannot come to him and take him to court and say, you had to sell it to me. אבל חכמים הגדירו אותו כמחוסר אמנה, as an unfaithful person, היינו כאדם שלא ניתן להאמין לו, ורק אם נאמר בפירוש שהסיכום אינו מחייב, מותר למוכר להעלות את מחיר המכונית. The only way he can do it is if he said originally that I'm making a general agreement with you, but it's not binding. If it's like a bli neder. If you said originally a bli neder, then you could get out of it. Okay? In other words, this is exactly the circumstance where the Chachamim said, you're mechusar amana. If you have a deal with somebody and something else comes up that maybe could give you a better deal, but it's not because the price of the car changed. The price of the car did not change. And by the way, there is a price of the car. I know this, I bought a car at a dealership. There was I forget what the book is. It's Levi Yitzchak. Is it called Levi Yitzchak? What's it called? Anybody know?
Yeah, Levi Yitzchak.
Levi Yitzchak, which is, Levi Yitzchak in Berditchev would be very, very proud. There's an actual price. It's very kavua. It even has tricks to it. I know because I'll tell you a story. I went to buy the car, and I'm a friar. I know I'm an American. They're going to take advantage of me. But I went in eyes wide open, and the guy tells me the price. Okay, fine. I go. I take the price. I say I have to think about it. I went online with some of my colleagues at work. I went on the internet. There's a way to find out what the price for certain cars should be based on the year, based on the model, whatever. And I found online that actually he seemed to be overcharging me by a couple of thousand shekel. I said, oh, this is great. I'm going to actually go to him. I'm going to say, look, I looked it up online. I know you're overcharging me. I went back to him. I said, this is what I found online. He said, okay, let's take a look. I said, look, I have this book. Let's look up at the book what it says your car should cost. I went, we looked in the book, and lo and behold, in the book, it says the price that I found on the internet. It was the same price. I said, look at me. You're doing it to my face. You're overcharging me to my face. He says, hold on. He says, see this price? What's right next to it? There's a kochavit. I said, okay. He says, where does the kochavit go? It goes down to the bottom. Let's look down to the bottom together. What does it say on the bottom? Oh, it says basically on the bottom. Anybody know what it says on the bottom of the book? What the kochavit is? Anybody know?
So it says, that the wholesale price?
No.
Go ahead, Dave. Do you know this bone?
Not for Americans.
No. It says that, let's say, for example, you're buying a Kia Carens, like I was buying a Kia Carens from 2015. Okay. So it says the price for a Kia Carens of 2015 is X. However, that's the price for a Kia Carens that was manufactured in January of 2015. However, you add certain 100 shekel, like let's say 300, I forget now, 300, 400, maybe even 600, I don't remember, like a few hundred shekel for every month into the year. So if the Kia Carens is from August, then it's 8 times a few hundred shekel that you add to the price. So there's a very precise price for every single car in the market, basically to the month. Whatever month the car is from, and it's on the registration, obviously, it's on the registration of the car, says what month it's from. So it's based on that. So what I'm trying to get across is that the price of a car is pretty fixed. Of course, you can get a deal, you can find somebody, whatever, but there is a market price for the car. And so when you make a deal for the car, if tomorrow somebody comes and is willing to pay you more, that's not a legitimate reason, Rav Melamed says, to break your deal with the first person. Now he says, however, he acknowledges, if the price of all cars goes up from the time that you agreed, let's say you agreed with somebody in January, and for whatever reason, you didn't get to actually sell the car until February. And between January and February, all the Ford dealerships blew up. And you know, and you're selling a Ford Focus, whatever. And now your price of your car skyrocketed because there's no more, right? So, alternatively, the price of the shekel changed drastically. Such that if you can say, I didn't know that the price would drastically change or that the value of the shekel would drastically change, as we saw last time. In this situation, there's two opinions. So the Ramah quotes two positions. One that says that when nishtana hashar, when there's a drastic change, that you can renege, you can go back on it, and one that says you cannot. Now, anybody remember how the Ramah paskened over there? So the Ramah paskened that we should be more machmir and we should not change, but the Shach comments and says he doesn't think that that's the minhag. He thinks the minhag is that you can change. Now he points over here. Ayin sma. And I think I remember looking last time that this seemed to me to be a little bit reversed, right? Because over here, as I pointed out, it says that the second position is mutar, and we saw the Rama explicitly says that the minhag is not to do it. And here he says the ashnia is the Rama. But okay, either way, it doesn't matter. The point is that there are two positions over there. And as I said, the Shach seems to think that you can be mako. I just want to point out that Rav Asher Weiss also brought up that there are two positions, and he says that it seems to him that in most Batei Din they follow the second position to be Mekel, like I said, like the Shach. And so there is room in such an extreme difference between if the price of a car drastically changes, the market price, you can renege, essentially. Now he makes one last point. Mashal Adam Shitanyan Bachanut Lagabe Kniyat Tanur. Let's say you wanted to buy an oven. You're going to come and buy it at night. The seller also can't sell it to somebody else. He's giving other examples of situations like this. This is a big deal, right? You can't, if you find the tanur somewhere else, you can't go and buy it. This, I think, comes up very often, right? You go to a store, you say, hold this for me, okay? This is a big deal, right? Hold this for me, and let's say, even more than hold this for me, order this for me, right? This happens. Order this for me. The store orders something for you, expecting you're going to buy it because they don't keep it in stock because nobody else buys it. And then you go and you find it in another store. This is Dad, I don't remember if you remember this, but this was a plot on a Seinfeld episode. Elaine wanted a certain pen and she went to the store and she asked the guy to buy it. I think the plot was that the guy wanted a date with Elaine. And so he went out of his way and he went to the warehouse to go get it. And then Elaine ended up buying it somewhere else and she felt really bad. So she went back to the store and she apologized to the guy. And then the guy made her feel bad and so she gave him a date. That was the plot over there. But over here it's saying, let's say you order from a Sfarim store, okay? This happens all the time. I call up Masoret and I say, do you have the Sefer? And they say, we don't have it, but we'll order it for you. And then what could I do? You know what I could do? I could call up Agut and I could say to them, do you have the Sefer? And what if they say, oh, we have it already? So now what do I do? Masoret has already ordered the Sefer. Can I now go to Agut? Because they already have it now. Agut has it right now. Maybe they even have it for a cheaper price. Can I buy it from Hagut and then go back to Masoret and say, sorry, I bought it already? Can I do that?
No.
David, you sound like you're in slow motion.
No.
You think no?
No.
All right, I agree. I think that's what the Rav Melamed is saying. He says, you cannot go and buy it somewhere else if you already agreed. Now, Masoret can't call up me up afterwards and say, you know, give me the money. They can't. They have no claim on me. I only made a verbal agreement. But it's not the right thing to do. Rock. However, if I tell them, listen, you know, if you order it for me, there's a chance I'm going to get it from you, but I'm going to look elsewhere also, right? Then that's okay. On both sides, by the way. If I tell Masoret, oh, you know, I may come and get it, then they can also sell it to somebody else, right? Nobody's made any obligations to anybody. But the moment that you say, I'm going to come and get it, that's a verbal agreement. It's not binding legally, but it's asur to break it. Okay? Okay, now.
It's hard to me a little bit to understand the phrase. It's asur, although it's not binding legally.
Well, it's unethical. Asur,
if it's ethical, it doesn't make it asur.
Asur
to me means it's asur. It's a halacha. You're not allowed to.
That's right. But there's a difference between something being asur and you being liable for something, right? I don't even think this rises to the level of kedoshim tiyu, because this is very basic, right? Something could be wrong to do, but not stealing. Okay, right? It's not stealing to do it. It's not stealing to say I'm going to renege on this, but it's still wrong to do. It's mechusar amana. I don't think it's such a chiddush. Maybe you think it's such a chiddush. I don't think it's so surprising that something could be wrong and yet you're not be liable for it. We definitely have this.
Can you think of another example which is analogous to this?
I mean, there are all kinds of areas of halacha. I mean, we definitely have patur of al asur, right? You have situations where it's asur to do something, but there's no malkut, okay?
Now, right.
There, it's really asur. Now, over here, this is even less, because I don't think it's not asur midoraita, necessarily. It's just mechusar amana and the chachamim say mishapar. I don't know, asur midoraita or not. Actually, it's a good question, whether or not it's asur midoraita or not. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. Now, Jake, we talked about this last time. You wanted to talk about, I don't know why I still called it the diamond handshake. This is a diamond agreement, because it's not actually a handshake, as we said last time. This is what we brought up last time with Mazel Ubrecha. So I told you I would show you Rav Moshe Sternbach. Rav Moshe Sternbach is, I think, is the head of the Aida Haredis now. He used to be just a big rabbi in South Africa, and he's written several volumes of tshuvas. Remember Rabbi Beller told me once that he was on the plane, and he saw Rav Moshe Sternbach writing tshuvas. He wanted to go over to him, but he didn't want to interrupt him. He was on a plane just writing and writing and writing. He's written tons of tshuvas. So he says, when people sell diamonds, they just say mazal bracha, and then that's the end of the transaction, meaning that's considered good enough. So is that true? So he quotes the Maharshag, who says, what's situmta? Situmta is a conventional kinyan. It's a kinyan that exists in the modern times. Like, it's not one of the classic kinyanim, like meshicha or hadba'a or even chalipin or anything like that. It's just something that people assume that this is the end of a transaction. Normally, a situmta is some kind of action that you do. Okay? But what about words? What about if you state something? So he says, you can achieve a kinyan even with words. But the data marshag, the eno moil, marshag says, no, you cannot, you can never have. So the marshag says you can, the marshag says you can't. I know it's confusing. The rush also says that you can never have a kinyan with just words. Because it's just a minag and it's not a good minag. Okay, fine. Now he says, Dvarv Tmuin. So this is amazing. So Moshe Sternbach says, I don't understand. Over there, you're talking about selling small, little, cheap things. So if I say, okay, I want to buy a stack of paper, so it's not good enough for me to use words to achieve that kinyan. But here we're talking about selling diamonds, and you can't expect people to bring diamonds with them everywhere they go. There's a reason why they have mazel bracha, because it's dangerous to be carrying millions of dollars of worth of diamonds everywhere you go. You need a way to do this in a secure fashion. So they don't bring the diamonds to the transaction. They say mazal bracha, and then they find a secure way to transfer the diamonds. Can't demand people to always do mishicha and hagbah every single time with diamonds. It's dangerous. So he says it's a good minhag to do it with dibur ba'alma. It's not a bad minhag. And he says it could be that even according to the Rush who says that it's a bad minhag to do these kinds of transactions with words, this is actually a good minhag. And that's how he wants to understand it. So the Rosh Steinbach is very interesting. He says it could be that modern day, you can have a situation in modern day where the circumstances change and there's a good reason to use a verbal agreement, and it might actually be completely and legally binding, because it's dangerous to carry those diamonds around, okay? By the same token, I would think that a handshake, which is an actual action, could legitimately be a situmta, even nowadays, because it's been established as being something that that people use to make a deal. Okay, it's gonna be a short share tonight, I think, because we're gonna finish with this. Two nice little stories that I wanna end with about the theme of keeping your word. And here it's not even keeping your word, it's keeping your mind. Okay? So there's two famous stories. One of them is not in a Gemara anywhere. It's just a story that shows up in Rashi and Makot, and it shows up in the Shi'otos, the Rav HaGaon, in Parshas Vayechi. And the story goes like this. You probably have heard the story before. It happened that Rav Safra had some wine for sale, and a potential buyer came to him while he was reciting the Shema. The customer said, "Sell me the wine for such and such a price." But Rav Safra couldn't answer because he was in the middle of saying Shema. Now, assuming that he was unwilling to settle for the price offered, the customer added to his original offer and said, "Sell me the wine for such and such a price." Rav Safra still didn't answer. So he kept going up and up and up and up and up and up. It took Rav Safra a while to daven Shema, you know. Upon finishing the Shema, Rav Safra finally said to him, "From the time you made your first offer, I had resolved in my mind to sell it to you," which means Rav Safra was actually paying attention to the man while he was saying Shema. He just couldn't respond. "Therefore, I will take no greater amount than your first bid." He agreed to take the first amount, even though the price went up. Now, this is beyond a verbal agreement. He didn't even make a verbal agreement. Rav Safra is saying, "Since I agreed to you in my mind, that was already something that's binding me to say, I have to sell it to you at this price." That's just between Rav Safra and God. And he says, there's no question that if he had said, "I will sell you this," but even if he merely resolved in his mind to sell something at a particular price, even if he didn't articulate it, he should not go back on that resolution. So this is what it's telling you. Rav Safra is saying that he goes even beyond just a verbal agreement. To just even think that I'm going to sell it to a person, that's enough. This is what's called, I think, midat chasidut. This is not something that's required of people. If you're... I'm trying to imagine cases where somebody offers you money and then for some reason offers you even more money. I don't think you're obligated to take the first amount. This is midat chasidut. This is above and beyond. Okay, but that's the story. And you have a similar story, less famous. The firm of Beer Sondheimer and Company is reported to have owed its tremendous expansion to the following fact. On a Friday in 1870, just before the Franco-German War broke out, Mr. Beer left his office for Shabbos. He had large holdings in copper and other metals necessary for the waging of a war. The porter received a number of telegrams, which he presented on Sunday morning to his employer. They came from the war ministry and offered to buy all metals in the possession of Mr. Beer. Each successive wire increased the price. Now, there was no response because it was Shabbos, right? When Mr. Beer on Sunday went through the messages, he informed the War Department that he would have accepted the first offer, that he failed to answer it because it was a Sabbath. He was therefore prepared to let the government have all his merchandise at the rate originally suggested to him. The war ministry was so impressed by this example of living Judaism that they made the firm its main supplier and thus established its global significance. Now, the truth is, I don't know what this company is. And we're talking about basically the company that, what, sold weapons to Germany? But you get the point. I think it was Rabbi Sachs who used to say very often that non-Jews, they respect us when we respect ourselves, when we respect our religion. That's the message over here from this story. That when they see that we're serious about Sabbath, about the Shabbat, then they take our Shabbat seriously. When they see that we're not serious about it, then they don't take us seriously. I think there was a story about was that in that Avner book, in that the book The Prime Ministers? There was a story about the food.
Yehuda Avner.
Yehuda Avner, the story with the food, right? That he went to eat in a meal. Dad, how does the story go?
He was accompanying Prime Minister Rabin to a presidential dinner at President Ford's White House. And according to the story, they gave Avner a fruit platter with a large topping of whipped cream because he was kosher. And when President Ford asked, why does he have that? Rabin said that it's his birthday. So Ford got up and started singing happy birthday to him. And when he asked Rabin, why did you tell President Ford it was my birthday? He says, you know, if word got out that kosher food was available at the White House, but I didn't have it, but my aide did, it would have caused a big scandal. So that's why he told President Ford that was your birthday.
Right. That is the story from the book. I was thinking of a different story. There was a story where, I guess didn't have to do with Israel, where there was a Jewish person in the White House or something, and there was a meal that was being served, and he got a special meal, and I think there were other Jews that were making fun of him or something like that, because they weren't religious. And then
Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, what happened?
Alan Dershowitz was clerking for the Supreme Court Justice Goldberg. What was his name? Arthur Goldberg. He was a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, and he was invited to Goldberg's house for a Seder. And at first he said yes, and then it occurred to him he really should go back home to Boston and spend the Seder with his family. So after a couple of days, he said no to Dershowitz. He said no to Goldberg, and Goldberg let him have it after Pesach. He said to him, the Vice President of the United States, Hubert Humphrey, came to my Seder, and he had to have kosher food because you ordered kosher food and you weren't even there. So Nebuch, I had to serve kosher food to the Vice President.
Yeah. All right. I think we're going to stop there. A little short share tonight. Next time we'll go on to some other interesting tshuvas. Maybe we'll talk about something I was going to do this past Shabbos, but didn't end up getting to do it, as Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin passed away a few weeks ago, and he has four Sefarim of tshuvas. So maybe we'll do that. We'll talk about some of his interesting tshuvas, mostly about women's issues, specifically about tefillah and women. He has some interesting ideas over there that could be worth taking a look at. All right.
Yeah.
Shkoyach. Everybody have a great night.
Next time you call me for stories, give me a heads up so I can think about them first.
No problem.